Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein with another conversation. Before we get to it, a word about our sponsor. The University of Dallas is a premier Catholic liberal arts institution, renowned for its rigorous core curriculum and thriving graduate programs. Careers in ministry, teaching, business, humanities, and science are formed here. With campuses in Texas and Rome, Italy, students begin their pursuit of a life well lived. We have two alums of Dallas here at First Things on staff, and they are both superb. For more information on the University of Dallas, visit udallas.edu. That's udallas.edu. John Mark Reynolds is president of the St. Constantine School and former provost of Houston Christian University. He was founder and director of the Torrey Honors College at Biola University before that. His writings include When Athens Met Jerusalem, An Introduction to Classical and Christian Thought, and an edited volume, The Great Books Reader. He joins us today to discuss great books, classical education, the current scene, locally for him and nationally. Welcome, Dr. Reynolds. You have a PhD, Dr. Reynolds.
Yeah, it's good to be here. John Mark is fine. However, if you would like to do that, we have enough titles between the two of us. We could just keep bandying titles back and forth, and no one will care.
Okay. Herr Professor Dr. Reynolds, maybe. So, okay. All right. So let's go back to the Torrey Honors College at Biola. That was a great books curriculum. What led you to start that project?
Yeah, I was doing a postdoc with a guy named Phil Johnson, who was a UC Berkeley law professor. And I went out to Biola to talk philosophy of science with J.P. Moreland, who was a distinguished philosopher, still is a distinguished philosopher at Biola, getting out of grad school, kind of thinking about the world. And when I got to Biola, it became clear to me, they were very clear when I came, hey, we'll help you with this postdoc, but we don't need any more philosophers. I said, great. I don't particularly want to work at a Christian university. I'm a Plato guy. But I got there and I saw that full-service universities often don't handle their gifted and talented students as well as they should. It's sort of like learning centers. Everybody knows that if you're a student at risk and they bring you in, that they need to provide some support. But gifted and talented students in a full-service university, a university that's dealing with the broader community, often doesn't put the resources in to the particular needs that gifted kids have. And so I proposed to them, because I had been mentored and taught to teach by Professor Al Geyer at the University of Rochester, who came through the whole Strauss. You got to use Strauss's notes when you had class with him. And so kind of had that influence. But he was very dialectical, even as compared to kind of the Straussian stream of thought, and very much into the Platonic kind of Socratic discourse. And so as I looked at Biola, I said, this is a way we could help the gifted students at Biola and have more gifted students go there. And so I proposed the Torrey Honors College. It was called the Torrey Honors Institute when it started. I was the first employee, and I think they have over 400 students now and maybe 17, 18 faculty that are totally attached to the program. And it was very exciting. We've seen hundreds of students come through that program. There are professors all over the world, really. For example, here in Texas, I think there are 3 full-time professors at Baylor University who are Torrey graduates who went to places like Oxford to do their PhDs. So it's been a very successful program in both attracting gifted and talented students and educating them at a deep level, not just to be glib, to be good at cocktail parties, to be able to name drop about great authors, but to go to class with everything on the line in every class they're in. And so it was an exciting time in life, and I really enjoyed doing it.
Great books. So, you know, if 20 years ago, a few of us professors went to the dean, Harvey Clare and Steve Kautz and Betsy Fox Genovese, and I went to the dean because Steve had gotten some funding to support a great books program at Emory if we wanted to start it up. And we went, he did a whole layout on this to the dean. And the dean said, well, that's pretty good. But do you have to call it great books? He didn't like that term, great books. Have you ever run into that attitude, John Mark?
Yeah, I run into it a lot. I think it's because there's a little bit of a holdover from the Great Books edition, kind of the Encyclopedia Britannica project, where people were selling great books of the Western world, kind of were afraid that people aren't reading anymore in the 1950s. And it became a little Chautauqua, you know, got that kind of, I don't share that. It's not the reason I read great texts and think about them. I have other rationale for it. But I think that got imprinted in a certain generation of administrators' mind. Now, of course, the other just fact of the matter is, even at a place like Biola University, a lot of faculty opposed starting Tory honors because they viewed it as kind of a right-wing thing.
Right.
Great texts often are viewed as a right-wing stalking horse to come into the university. It's very strange. You're teaching Socratically. Until I started blogging, most of my students had no idea what my politics were. And then when I became president, of course, of the college here, I stopped blogging about politics altogether. I don't think that's fair to my faculty. And so I don't see why that's true. But I think if the broader university has adopted the notion that even if there is truth, it isn't really knowable, then the notion of something like a canon, a rule, of a measuring stick, not just a list of books, but something that we're saying are these are excellent things. People should read The Republic because it's an important book and there's nothing comparable to it. So go read The Republic. That is, I guess, a conservative attitude in the sense that if you progress beyond it or you think that that's hopelessly false, it's a little reactionary.
Was there a multiculturalist objection? Great books going back is going to be, yes. End up being, you know, the 80s word was Eurocentric. Now, you know, Western, yes. Bias or dead white male. What do you say to the people who make that objection?
Yeah, even at Biola, that was a very big objection from the English department, from the history department. Again, it was a backwards move from their point of view. We'd just outgrown, you know, our narrowness and Eurocentric approach to the curriculum. And this Reynolds guy wants to take us backwards. And I think the answer to that is twofold. St. Constantine College here is from the Orthodox tradition. We're actually born out of a community that is dominantly Palestinian and Lebanese and Syrian. And so just calling the canon Western is an odd thing to do to begin with. You know, when you're reading St. Gregory or when you're reading Basil, you're reading somebody from Asia, what we might call Asia Minor or modern day Turkey today. Is that East or West? Is the Eastern Roman Empire Eastern or Western? But forget all of that for a minute. We were teaching in an English language university where people were predominantly going to leave and speak English in their workplace. And if you dive down into the roots of the English language, you're going to be looking at, in modern English, things like Shakespeare, the King James Bible. What are the roots of the language as we have it? And what are the roots of the ideas that form the American polity that you're going to go live in? And that's just going to end up being Christian, Jewish, Greek, Roman writings. And even if that's not desirable, even if we wish that we were starting from a different starting point, that's what you're going to end up reading. When I did educational tour in Mongolia right after the fall of communism, and I talked to people, I would start talking to them about Mongolian culture to learn about it. And they were less interested in that than you would think. They did want to restore their language. They did want to think about the nature of Buddhism, for example, because the Soviets had helped stamp it out. But they had had to deal with Marxism. They were looking at free markets. They were looking at kind of the ideas that had shaped their last 70, 80 years as a nation. And those were ideas where understanding Plato, understanding Marx, understanding Nietzsche, these were all important things for them to do. Because whether you like it or not, for example, if you embrace modern science, then understanding Aristotle and Plato and the history of the philosophy of science is going to tend to be a Greco-Roman, some Islamic, some Jewish thought, but a lot of Christian thought as well. So it's pretty much unavoidable. And to pretend that we can avoid it is to keep our students from having the language of power that they need to understand the basement of the civilization they're going to live in. And if you hide from the basement, creepy things can go on down there that you don't even know about and you don't even like.
Yeah.
It's like the horror movie. But if you go down in the basement, you explore it, it becomes part of who you are, then I find a lot of my students can look at 20th century and then now 21st century literature, and they kind of get it very quickly because these roots show. If you haven't read Plato, then you don't realize how Platonic everything is.
Hmm.
But once you read Plato, you see Plato everywhere.
I guess I have to favor your response to the multicultural objection better than my response, which at this point is, you do what you do, I'll do what I do. See you later. Anyway, you're on the board of directors.
Well, that's right. I mean, I also think there's a problem with becoming sort of glib where, you know, at one point in the program, we started to say we should read a translation of Confucius, but we eventually took it out at Tory Honors, and we don't do that here at St. Constantine, not because that's not an important text to read, but because sort of superficially reading one thing from Chinese culture, you know, the many Chinese cultures, is stupid, as opposed to really, really, really getting to know American English-based culture as well as we can, which is already going to be enormously superficial for undergraduates. So, you know, you spend the rest of your life reading the first line of the Republic since I've done that. And so you're already reading texts that are incredibly difficult too quickly.
Right.
So, you know, trying to master 15 cultures or, you know, getting a smattering of global, what does it even mean to talk about global cultures? How many are there?
Oh, I know. Let's not use the term global ever again, okay?
That's right.
So,
let's say this. When St. Basil is talking to young men who are heading to the academy to study Homer, and my students are reading Homer and reading St. Basil and reading then St. Thomas Aquinas, they're involved in a same convert or similar conversation. These are people that are all talking to each other by way of Homer, and they have Homer in common. I guess Homer was not involved in the conversation because he's a kind of root text to the conversation. And so then I can meaningfully become part of that conversation. But if I read a bunch of authors who have no knowledge of each other because they're isolated civilizationally from each other, this is not unlike dropping into a city, I feel like, and eating at McDonald's every place you go. Oh, I've been to Rome and I had a Big Mac there. I've been to, you know, Ulaanbaatar and had a Big Mac there. It's insane. You're not really seeing anything about the civilization. Whereas at least all my students have had a conversation about Homer by way of, let's say, 20, 30 authors who themselves were reflecting on or had been impacted by the Iliad and the Odyssey.
You're on the board of directors of the Orthodox Christian School Organization. What's the current situation of those schools?
Yeah, Orthodox education is in its earliest stages. When Orthodox people came to the United States, and that would have started with the Russians in Alaska, that's the only part of the United States dominantly Orthodox. So there are parts of the Aleutian Islands where the Orthodox people are the majority of the culture. The Russian Orthodox Church is the majority of the culture. Everywhere else, Orthodoxy, tiny minority community, tiny immigrant community, which has gone through the same process of every Ellis Island type community, which is going from kind of poverty, working in restaurants, family businesses, to now I've been told that the Orthodox are the wealthiest religious group in the United States. They're a real U.S. success story. And so now they're looking around and saying, we've utilized Catholic education, we've utilized evangelical universities. Obviously, Biola, where I worked, was an evangelical school. Houston Christian was a Baptist, historically, school. Maybe it's time for us to build our own bus instead of sitting in the back of somebody else's bus and do a little bit of the driving. Because the other thing about Orthodoxy is we're a good host. Nobody in the U.S. thinks we're suddenly, we don't proselytize by nature other Christians. And so if we build a table and invite everybody to come and sit, we can safely do that. And on the whole, we're also not given to change. So in a religious environment where the center isn't holding for a lot of groups, we're not narrow-minded, we're not fundamentalist in orientation, But we're also, everything's not up for grabs, right? The Nicene Creed, we're not sitting thinking about whether we should get rid of it or if it's true. And our bishops aren't reconsidering everything under the universe. So we're not without problems. See Russia and the Ukraine. So we can't become triumphalist. But at the same time, I think in the U.S. context, we're a safe host for things like the college here, and then the college working on a new idea, which is the integration of K through 12 with undergraduate college education.
Are Orthodox Christian schools multiplying?
Yeah, they are multiplying. I think they're multiplying more as a series of sort of homeschool support groups on steroids, you know, where there might be one or two employees and about 100 students. There are a couple of K through 12s in the U.S. that are between 60 and 100. St. Constantine itself is about 550 students K through college. That would make us, I think, the largest Orthodox oriented school in the U.S., though only about 20% of our students are Orthodox. If the Orthodox are going to start a school, we're opening a campus in Pittsburgh. We will again be opening a campus that's truly Orthodox. Nobody will be confused about that. But most people we serve will be Roman Catholic, Evangelical, or even here in Houston, we serve the Chinese atheist community. Houston is one of the most diverse cities in the United States. And if you're an engineer who comes to Houston and wants a good school, we're a very good academic school. And if your kid ends up believing in God because they come here, I don't know what to tell you. We're not proselytizing. We're just thinking really hard.
Okay. Is there anything that would distinguish an Orthodox Christian classical school from, say, a Catholic classical school, apart from the theology classes and the liturgies?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'll give you a twofold answer to that. Yeah, leaving aside the liturgical or the pastoral elements, we have chapel every day. And obviously, that would have its own perspective. But it's twofold. First of all, when you look at most curricula, they tend not to heavily read the Eastern Fathers. They depend on them. But there's a much more Augustinian approach. Whereas the Cappadocian fathers, St. Gregory of Nyssa, St. Gregory the Great, Basil the Great, John Chrysostom, who wrote our liturgy and did series of sermons, these are all people that are read in the West of the world and have influenced Western theology. See St. Thomas Aquinas's many references, or the Protestant Reformation's many references to particularly the Cappadocian fathers. But they're not often read in great books curricula, and we do here. Kindergarten through the college programs, there's an emphasis on those aspects of the Christian faith that you wouldn't find a lot of places academically. And the second thing is the Orthodox do global Christianity pretty well. So whereas a lot of Christian classical schools are very, very Western, and I would say we're pretty Western because we intend our students to live here in America. Most of them, because we're located in Houston and soon Pittsburgh, and Dallas will be the next location after that. Yet still, may not be so different for Catholic schools, a broader emphasis because of our long-term relationship, for example, with Ethiopia and with Egypt. And so those churches. So there's a little bit of a more global perspective that you might get out of a school like ours.
Yeah.
We do Greek pretty naturally, too. For example, we teach Latin, but Greek is more central to us than Latin.
Yeah. So the demand is there.
I mean, we're the Eastern Roman Empire.
Yeah. The demand,
oh, yeah.
Demand is up.
Yeah. It's there. We have waiting lists in all our classes.
Great. Great. Your school opened in 2015, I read. When did you arrive?
Yes. I was the first employee. So I arrived in 2014, I was following the conventional sort of academic administrative path, had started Tory Honors, had started some things at HBU, kind of revised the Honors College that was already there before I came, but helped it grow, brought in a new director, started a film program there, a Christian apologetics program, really enjoyed my time at HCU, and then was offered a conventional college presidency. And that would have been the natural thing to do. But I became very, very worried about the debt load that students were picking up in going to school. And I became very worried about the long-term viability of liberal arts colleges in period.
Yeah.
Like the model isn't working. And one thing I noticed was every little liberal arts college was killing itself by trying to add doctoral programs and master's degree programs. And so, you know, spinning up programs that weren't necessary, producing, you know, MAs and PhDs that might be second tier at best, third tier, fourth tier in many cases. And they weren't really making money and were unnecessary. And so I paused and said, after the Second World War, we kind of created this K through 12 and then college system. And there's nothing natural about that, this division. So what if we grew the other way? What if we started a liberal arts college with one-on-one Oxford tutorials and then built down into high school so that as a small college, my students have access to 100 employees instead of maybe the 14, you know, professors you might normally get at a micro college. You have access to like 100, as many as 100 different teachers. And it's also true of our high school, right? So I have a PhD from Rice teaching biology in the high school who can also teach in the college. I can attract that kind of scholar teacher because I have work for them to do.
Yeah.
So if you grow backwards and get rid of the snobbery that says second grade teachers are somehow inherently dumber than college professors or so different they couldn't possibly both work for the same organization, you really can make some progress. And we've gone far enough now that we know the system works. We know that you can do that.
This is an interesting model. Anyone copying this?
As far as I know, no. As far as I know, we're unique. There are plenty of colleges that have K through 12s attached to them that run them, but where they're fully integrated. So I have a classicist who teaches Greek to second graders, but also teaches Greek to college students. Because why not? Now, not everyone, you know, is a four-tool player and can teach at every level. I have, a philosopher who's coming in, a philosopher of science, and they're very good at mathematics, and they'll teach some high school math and teach, obviously, some college philosophy. Probably not going to teach in the elementary school. But if we hire someone, the ultimate resource would be somebody who can teach at every level. And we have a few of those people. I'm not one of them. The other thing we've done is we've eliminated all full-time administration. We have no full-time administrators. There are no secretaries here. There's nobody who doesn't teach. Teachers do all the work.
Hmm.
I teach a half load, what would be considered a half load, in the college.
We'll see if it catches on. It'll be interesting to see in the coming years.
Well, I hope it does, because we're one of the few places that if you come to college here, you can do the full out tutorial, like where you're meeting one on one with somebody working on your paper. We do have group class discussions like we did at Torrey Honors, but we can do that full out here because, again, we have access to enough faculty to make it viable. So I really hope so. I hope that this catches on. I also think it does eliminate a certain unnatural division. Almost every classical high school in the U.S. has two or three teachers that really they would be teaching at an undergraduate college if undergraduate colleges weren't dying and cutting out history and philosophy departments. So it's also a way for people who don't feel like they have a strong academic community in their area to be able to exercise all their gifts. Yeah, so we'll see.
Yeah, yeah. A bigger question, sort of off to the side.
Please.
You've got a self-critical temperament, John Mark. As you've witnessed the growth in classical education in recent years, can you think of any examples of mistakes that classical educators have made? Where they've gone maybe a little wrong now and then?
Yeah, I would say the classical Christian school movement, in fact, is coming to a crossroads, and it's an important crossroads. And I think there are two ways to get the temperature of what I'm trying to say. One is, how does a classical Christian school deal with religious minorities? So imagine everyone went to a classical Christian school. Imagine that somehow the ideas in a classical Christian school movement prevailed. How do we deal with religious minorities? And the history of classical Christian behavior towards religious minorities is a pretty mixed bag, if you look at it. And we have to learn something from that. Are we just exploiting other ideas? I mean, it's as simple as, are we reading Plato to find out, you know, like cherry pick what's Christian about Plato and discard the rest, sort of reading him through a pre-existing lens? Or are we truly reading the text and understanding it in its own right and using it to examine ourselves and even our faith? Are we constantly dialectically challenging ourselves? So the second thing I would say is, to me, the heart, the canon of classical education is the dialectical or the Socratic process itself, not a list of books. The list of books comes out of the rule, and a central part of the rule is the method. And the method is this, I'll say it simply, I think you have to love a book to understand it fully. So when I read a book from a different religious tradition, I try to understand why the people in that religious tradition love that book, venerate it, and think it's important. And until I can get to that point, I don't think I've understood that book in its own right. And I think too often, particularly in religious classical schools, but even in ones that are more conservative in their orientation, and I certainly would, most people would describe me as a political conservative. I guess maybe I'm a monarchist in some ways. He says, amusingly, Jesus being a monarch and not a Republican or a Democrat, I'm told. But I think we could make the mistake of not putting this dialectical interchange at the center of what we do. That God is hidden and went on the road to Emmaus with two disciples, Jesus, and didn't reveal himself immediately, but allowed them to question him, and they had a discussion about the text before he revealed himself to them, is, I think, an important element in education that especially religious classical schools often skip over. And we become almost catechizing vehicles. We replace churches instead of being classical.
One of the things
that you asked. I think.
Well, you don't really like the achievement focus that a lot of parents have for their kids. Achieve, success. When parents come to St. Constantine, right, to inquire about enrolling their kids, is the whole achievement focus still strong with them? And if so, do you try to address that?
So we're in Houston. Houston, we have a problem. Lots of engineers in Houston, maybe the most engineers of any place in the country. We're exceedingly diverse as a city, and we have very achievement-oriented people. It's a university town. We're the home of Rice University, which is arguably academically the best school in Texas, and University of Houston, very large, lots of religious colleges. So Houston is, oddly enough, we have NASA, obviously, famously, so astronaut city. My wife has a book group with our former students, one of whom, she's a rocket scientist for NASA, and that's a very common thing here. So sometimes people think Texas, and they don't understand that Houston itself is more like Gulf, city, what New Orleans used to be in many ways, capital, finance center, medical center. And so when I get those kinds of parents, they definitely want their kid to be able to go to Rice or to the Ivies or some of the fine schools, and they're very achievement focused. And they may not want to send their kids here.
Yeah.
Because we can get you into Rice. Classical education works if that's your focus. But that's not our focus here. So, for example, having started a college that then started a high school that started a K through 6, we don't give homework through fifth grade. We let kids play outside. They have at least an hour outside a day through fifth and sixth grade, because you no longer can expect that kids get outdoor time, play time on their own.
Yeah.
We've actually had to step back. So if you want your kid to be maxed out fifth grader, you know, just the best test scores they possibly can get in sixth grade, we're not the place for you.
Okay.
On the other hand, we aren't going to burn your kid out.
Yeah.
Because we go right through college, we have a long view of a kid's intellectual development. But after all, intellectual development is only part of the story with education. And this is where that bugbear character education virtue actually matters.
Right.
Teaching a kid to read is good, but teaching them to have a whole soul is better. Why not both,
yeah.
I say.
Yeah. Well, look, that'll do it for us, John Mark. Well, I want you to come back when the Pittsburgh school opens, and I want you to give us an update on that, if you would. But for now, John Mark Reynolds, St. Constantine School, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was a privilege.